It's week 12, and the conference is under attack. Part of it internal, part of it external. But Larry Scott must do something about it. Do you think he'll do it? What's going on with all the recruiting rankings? Who's moving up? Who's moving down? And we're going to go over all the games. I'm George Reister with Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles. This podcast is for Pac-12 people. You guys make sure that you guys share the feed, tell a friend about the podcast, and always leave a comment, engage, send us an email to imad@unafraidshow.com. Ralph, the conference is under attack right now. There's an internal attack and there's an external attack. We'll start with the internal attack first. That is the Pac-12 referee. I mean, I can't get over what is going on. So this week we find out that there was a referee suspended and an entire crew was downgraded, whatever the hell that means. And the reason why is because in the Washington State versus Cal game, the after a kickoff, Washington State returned the kickoff to the 50-yard line. And then there was a personal foul penalty assessed to a guy who wasn't even on the field, to a number of a player who wasn't even on the field. And then it was given to, the penalty was awarded in Cal's favor. So, and they were saying the penalty was way back, was way back. It was a 15-yard penalty. And so Washington State started the ball on their own 8-yard line. But where the ball was actually supposed to be spotted was Cal's 35-yard line. So this is a 57-yard difference. Washington State goes down, kicks a field goal. But it, do you think it would have been much easier to score a touchdown if you start on the other team's 35? So the referee was suspended. The crew was downgraded. And this is just literally, Ralph, 1 week after. 1 week after Larry Scott made the comments saying that, yeah, I know. I sit down with David Coleman, the head of our officiating, and I can tell you there's a significant number of mistakes every week. Okay, so what are you going to do about it? I don't even know what to make of this, Ralph.
The Pac-12 is in a really weird place right now as far as their officiating. There's will and there's skill. Is it that the Pac-12 refs don't want to be better? Or is it that they can't be better? So they've tried the carrot. The carrot is you get better games if you do better. And that hasn't necessarily worked out. And so now they're trying the stick. And I'm very curious to see how officiating crews react to a suspension and a downgrading for something that could have probably been doled out for any number of severely missed calls across several Pac-12 games this year. This one was egregious and it was really bad. Last year, Washington State, got screwed against USC. A couple of years before that, Washington State got a fifth down, to quote Dave Chappelle, 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth. And used that to score what ended up really being a back-breaking touchdown against Arizona State. That's not the only weird thing that's going on in officiating right now. There's a Pac-12 replay official named Jim Fogeltance. I don't know if you knew this, George, but let me paint you a picture. I just want to see how you'd feel about it. I want your gut reaction to this. What if there was a replay official and you went to Oregon Right? So what if there was a replay official who was a donor to University of Washington's athletic program? And he was put in charge of ultimately making serious replay decisions for the University of Oregon. Would you feel uncomfortable with someone who is an active donor to Washington's athletic program making decisions about University of Oregon?
Okay, yes. People go to their schools. They're proud of their schools. And we have to assume that people have some integrity in these situations. But at the same time, if you are an active donor, I think that there needs to be some distance between you and the university when you are in a position to adjudicate matters, because there's a big difference. I mean, because imagine if this dude was making a call that ended up, you know, like a game, like a replay call. I think when Zach Ertz was playing, when Stanford was playing against Oregon, Zach Ertz, that controversial touchdown to end the game when Andrew Luck was there. Like, imagine if he were making that call. I'd be pissed the hell off, because that was sketchy.
Okay. So what about last year's Arizona State-Oregon game where Frank Darby caught that two-point conversion inbounds and it went to replay? And it wasn't overturned. What if I told you that that replay official's name is Jim Fogeltance, that he works a bunch of Arizona State games, and that he has 2 degrees from the University of Arizona and is a donor to their athletic program?
Ouch. Oh, that looks really bad. That looks really bad, bro. I mean.
So I'm telling you this right now, while we have this other issue playing out in public with what happened in Cal versus Washington State, Ray Anderson and Arizona State President Michael Crow have been on Larry Scott. This is out there. They have been calling him for the last 2 weeks to try to get Jim Fogeltance off of Arizona State games. He was the one that was responsible for making the decision at the end of the game that Christian Rector actually kept possession of the interception that ended the USC victory over Arizona State, and he's set to be up in the booth for Arizona State Oregon in 2 weeks. So there are issues. Hey, of
keep him up there for 2 more weeks.
Yeah. But there's this battle that's playing out in public right now, and I'm telling you, there's also another battle that's playing out in private. That you know, at least Arizona State, and I think that anybody can be sympathetic to that, that just as a fan, what if somebody who donated to your rival was responsible for making critical calls for your team?
Oh, that's so there's sucks, dude.
So there's that, this that. Other thing that's playing out in private, that while Larry Scott is publicly posturing that Pac-12 officiating needs an adjustment, and he's out here publicly suspending one person, in private, he's turning around and telling Ray Anderson and Michael Crow, "Hey, tough titties, guys." And so, you know, I what it makes me wonder is how much of the punishment that's going to be going on for officials who blow calls is just to get some of the heat off of himself. How serious is Larry Scott about cleaning up some of the officiating in the Pac-12?
Oh, my Lord. Ralph, this is – okay, so when you put it like you put it – see, here's the thing. There's no controversy until there's a controversy. So if he were not making weird calls or something against Arizona State, nobody would notice. So it's one of those things that if you do your job properly with integrity – And objectively, if you are a person who can do that, then yes, you can be in that job. But if not, then you got to go. Like, if there's any hint of impropriety when it comes to replay officials, referees, I mean, you have seen the NFL and soccer take people off of games because they have a Facebook picture from 5 years ago with a Saints hat on or with a Man United hat on. And it just makes sense because the integrity of the game is probably one of the most important things. Probably the most important thing when it comes to sports. Fans need to feel like it's fair. And Larry Scott's not doing anything about it. Because think about this. John Canzano wrote a cool article about it. And he talked about, we both were at Pac-12 Media Day. That's actually how the Pac-12 Apostles, for those who don't know, how the Pac-12 Apostles podcast started. Me and Ralph were just talking, and all of a sudden it was a podcast. So at the Media Day, Commissioner Scott talked to, he was at the stage at the ballroom, and he said that Woody Dixon would no longer act as the Pac-12 supervisor of football. He wasn't qualified, all of this. He's the guy who called from his house. He called from his house and overruled the instant replay officials during the Washington State USC game with that hit on Gardner Minshew from his house. What in God's name? Come on, man.
And it's not new. It's not new. Check this out. I found an archived article from the LA Times dating back to 2002 saying that at one point the conference's coordinator of football officiating was a USC graduate, and that was something that UCLA had a massive issue with at one time. And also, Jim Fogeltans has been part of officiating Pac-12/Pac-10 games for so long that before Utah was part of the Pac-12, back when they were with the Mountain West, Utah coach Ron McBride filed an official complaint that Jim Fogeltans was a big University of Arizona guy because he lived in Tucson and had 2 degrees from there. So none of these complaints are new. They've been going on for almost 2 decades, and it's not just Arizona State University complaining about it. I think that you should probably make sure that everybody is free of any type of biases when they are officials. You're going to have people who graduated from, you know, Mountain West schools who are officiating Pac-12 games.
Yep. And okay, so, and then when Larry Scott said that Dixon was being removed from the equation and announced that David Coleman, the Pac-12 head of officiating, would answer to Scott himself, you know, closing the distance. Guess where Dixon was? He was in the back of the room, seated right next to David Coleman. So the guy you said you were removing from the equation was sitting right back there. I mean, and like, it's so ridiculous that Larry Scott has been able to con not only the old presidents, but the new presidents. You're sitting here, oh yeah, we're acknowledging the mistakes. Stop acknowledging and do something, dude. Like, you are destroying the integrity of the game. You are affecting outcomes of games. This is bowl berths. This is conference championships. These things, these are people's jobs. People get fired over not winning enough games. And you're sitting here affecting it. And then here is Larry Scott's biggest con job. Is that he's been, so there's a lot of the Pac-12 presidents and CEOs and chancellors that have had a lot of turnover the last few years. Here's his biggest con job, is that he's making $5.3 million a year, which is more than the Big Ten and SEC commissioner combined, and they're the two most popular conferences. His contract is up in 2022, but what does he spend all his time talking about, Ralph?
Officiating.
No. What is Larry Scott's biggest thing he always talks about?
Oh, the future.
The future and the 2024 media rights deal when it's up in 2024. Since his contract is up in 2022, isn't that real convenient timing? Hey guys, I really got a plan. And
I think it's probably the smartest thing that he's done.
Dude, tomorrow I'm talking on a podcast. I'm talking about I'm interviewing Corey DeBrua, who is Google's head of communication, global communication. Well, sorry, the vice president of global communication. So he is like super high up. I mean, like top 20 in at Google, top 20, 25 at Google, a near $1 trillion company. He's a huge Oregon guy. And he's in charge of global communication, PR, all of these things. And I'm like, I wonder, I'm going to ask him specifically about the Pac-12's, since he does messaging for a near $1 trillion company, I'm wondering how this works out. I'm going to ask him specifically about Pac-12 messaging and the integrity and all of that stuff. Because this is ridiculous, dude. Okay. So that's the internal, but okay. Do you believe Larry Scott will do anything about this, Ralph?
I mean, I guess he's already started. It's just a matter of how referees are gonna react, you know, what was better for them, the reward of being able to get better games if you grade out better, or the fear of getting suspended or downgraded if you seriously screw up. But not very many calls are that black and white, George. Like, for the most part, it's not something that you can get outright punished for because you called a penalty on somebody who isn't even on the field, which changes possession by 50-something yards. Usually the mistakes aren't that well, they're that obvious, but they're not that black and white as to what should be done about it. So I would say that he's made it look like he's trying, because I think that this is the biggest threat to not his legacy, but his job status. If officiating keeps eroding the institution and people stop having fun and people continue to not go to games, there's not really a reason to keep him around, because that's going to be something that gets brought to the negotiating table. When anybody says that they want to give them money to broadcast these games, they're gonna be like, hey, Larry, what are you doing about the officiating? Because we're going to broadcast these games. We want to make sure that people at least watch them on TV. And if it's just going to be, you know, something that's not even fun because it continually gets screwed up, like if people aren't going to stream it or whatever in Future Town, wherever these games are being broadcast, then that's the biggest problem. You know, I think that the people who bring the money to the table are the ones that he really has to answer to. And they're going to have questions about the officiating as well.
It's bad, dude. It's bad. And maybe you should train them better. Maybe you should maybe make full-time employees, because there's money to do that. Like, if you do that, you will improve the quality. And if they don't step up, then you fire them. I mean, it's super, super bad. It's really, really bad. So there's Pac-12 refs. Oh, and the external threat. The external threat is coming squarely from Paul Feinbaum. And the idea that you have so many analysts, college football analysts, talking about, oh, how the Pac-12 is dead, all of these things. But here is what Paul Feinbaum said yesterday on the top 25 committee rankings show, and then said it again this morning on Get Up, because Rob Mullins, Oregon Athletic Director, is the chair of the committee. And Paul Feinbaum keeps saying that the Pac-12 deserves no credit, and Rob Mullins basically is a fraud if Oregon makes it into the playoffs. And he keeps saying how if it comes down to Oregon and Alabama, that they'll have a conflict, and that basically questioning Rob Mullen's integrity. And I just thought that this was very, very interesting because like this is not the only time that somebody has been a chair. Like you had Oklahoma's athletic director, I believe, who was on the committee last year when Oklahoma got in as a one-loss team. But they're set up to recuse themselves when their teams are being talked about. So that means that the other committee members chose this person. You've had Barry Alvarez on the committee, who's now, Wisconsin's athletic director. This is total garbage. This is propaganda by ESPN. This is horrible. This is an attack on the conference. And Larry Scott, he's probably going to put out a statement because people are making enough noise about this. Oh, you know, Paul Feinbaum's comments were very unfortunate. While we do not agree with them, we respect people's opinions, and the committee has a very tough job, and Oregon and Alabama are both very fine football teams. That's probably what he'll say if he says anything. And we're just happy to be mentioned with the great teams in the world.
Well, Paul Feinbaum's a dork. Like, let's just get that out of the way. Like, he's got an enormous platform. He's got an enormous stage. He talks SEC football. He's done it longer than anybody, but there's a million people who do it better than him. He's just got a large platform. And when he's not talking football specifics, he has a very large tendency to stick his size 4 foot into his mouth. So there's not really, you know, anything that you can do about the fact that he's going to continue to say dumb stuff. The committee is built so that anybody who is involved in any voting process that might involve their team has to recuse themselves. I know this because a colleague of mine has been named to that committee. One of the best writers that we ever had down here in Arizona. Her name is Paula Boivin. She is a professor at Arizona State. And on all things Arizona State, she can't even be in the room. Right? So they've got a system in which they are addressing these things. And so for Paul Feinbaum to say that, like, it's corrupt in some way, man, shut up. They've taken two SEC teams multiple times. Like, it's fine. It's going to be fine. Stop crying, you pocket mouse balding weirdo.
Dude, it is a shame. I mean, it is a shame that nobody stands up for the conference. I mean, who is going to stand up and be a voice? I guess it's got to be me. I guess it's got to be me. It's got to be you, Ralph. It's got to be the people listening to the podcast. Because at some point in time, people keep just bullying you. And this is indicative of not just the college football playoff. It's indicative of TV time slots. Because when the new contract is up, you've kept accepting all these Thursday night games, Friday night games, bad time slots. What do you think they're going to offer you in 2024? What do you think that, you know, I mean, if you try to go to Hulu, if you try to go to Apple TV Plus, what do you think they're going to give you?
Hey, Days of Our Lives just stopped production, so maybe we can get some Pac-12 games on at noon on a weekday, dude, since they won't have to battle with Days of Our Lives anymore.
Yeah, and then they'll be telling us, hey, guys, hey, we're going to put some Tuesday night games on to compete with the MAC because we'll be the only thing on. Will be the biggest game in town.
I actually tweeted that the other day because of this whole Chase Young thing of, like, you know, suspending a guy for you know, taking a loan that he then paid off right away. And I said, you know, the NCAA, they're just trying to protect these student athletes because they know that the moment that you take money from somebody, it won't just be for nothing. They're going to start asking you to schedule games on Thursday nights.
That was a great tweet.
That was The NCAA, they are absolutely experts in this quid pro quo stuff and doing stuff that's not great for the student athlete. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that you're not going to have a ton of people come out and defend the Pac-12 because, you know, everybody's motivated by money. And if there's no money in the defense of the Pac-12 or in having a backbone here or in starting a war between the conferences, you're not going to see anybody step up and do it. It'd be nice for Larry Scott to step out there and say, like, hey, wait a minute, Paul Feinbaum, like you don't dictate any of this. And if we get somebody in, it's going to be because we play 9 conference games. And because we have a decent out of conference schedule and we're not playing and losing to Appalachian State in week 11, like SEC teams are, like, it would be nice if you had a little bit of bite there, but everybody's kind of laissez-faire and say like, oh, it'll work out the way it works out. And until it doesn't, right? And then you have all the complaining at the end of the year when you're in a New Year's Six Bowl instead of the college football playoffs sitting at 12-1.
Bro, somebody has to defend the conference. Somebody has to, dude. It's bad. In other news, Ralphie Five is gone. Ralphie. He is gone, Ralph. No, I'm joking. I know that Ralphie is a girl, but will they replace Ralphie with a boy? And Ralphie is going to go live off on a farm in a pasture. They said with a mate, right? With a companion.
Yeah, they got Ralphie a man, and they got Ralphie a field to graze in. They're really making it sound like the farm that my dog supposedly went to.
Who told you that your dog went to the farm?
My dad. So we had an American Eskimo, and it was like it would bite people. We had it till it was probably like 6 years old, and he wasn't neutered. And then one day he was gone, and I asked my parents. I was like, you know what happened to Murphy? Was the dog's name? And they said that a breeder from Colorado came down and got him because he wasn't neutered. So he's actually going to go like live a really, really good life in an area where he's not going to bite neighborhood kids anymore. And then I grow up and I hear all these stories of people telling their kids that their dog went off to a farm. And to this day, I cannot get my parents to admit that like that dog is anywhere but a farm in Colorado. It's been 20 years.
He's dead anyway.
But they haven't broken ranks on the story. So I'm still holding out hope that my skittish American Eskimo that would bite the neighborhood kids actually got to spend the rest of his life having sex in the mountains.
Bro, don't believe it. Florida and ASU have scheduled home and homes. In 2028, they're playing in Tempe. In 2031, they are playing in Florida. I love this. I love home and home matchups. ASU just had one with Michigan State. Turned out to be a little more of a dud when it was in Tucson, but it was good this last year. Jaden Daniels played really well. And what did they win that game? Like 10-6 or something? Like 10-7? So like that. That's great news. Around the conference, though, Chase Garber's Cal quarterback has been cleared. He may start this weekend against USC, which would be a big boost for – I don't know. We'll talk about that when we go about games. And Tyler Helinski will be honored at senior night at Washington State. He is the brother of the Helinski brother who plays at South Carolina now. And if you know the story, a year and a half ago? About a year and a half ago, he committed suicide when he was going to be the starting quarterback at Washington State, and it was, you know, sad and tragic, and it's just a horrendous story. But they're going to be honoring him at senior night. And we wanted to go over recruiting now. We wanted to go over some recruiting news because there have been some big changes in the Pac-12. So now I believe Washington overtook Oregon for the top recruiting spot in the Pac-12. They have one five-star, which is Savelle Smalls, I believe, and a bunch of four-stars and a bunch of three-stars. And then Oregon is in second place. Stanford, third. Arizona State, four. UCLA is bumped all the way up to five. Colorado, six. Cal, seven. Washington State, eight. Oregon State, nine. Wait. Arizona, 10. I must have missed you at USC in there, right? I got all the way to 10. This has to be a typo, right? USC at 11?
No. Yeah. Not only that, they just finished beating Arizona State, and right after the game, Jack Yeary, a 6'6", 250-pound tight end who saw the writing on the wall from them running the air raid, decides to decommit, and he might turn around. It's very possible that he might give his commitment. I mean, it's a small chance, but it's a chance that he might give his commitment to the team that USC just beat, because ASU doesn't really have any tight ends. And so things are not looking great for USC right now, but how about the last couple of weeks? And I can't believe I'm saying this, but how about the last couple of weeks for UCLA and Colorado? They're tearing it up on the recruiting trail. I mean, we got Colorado got a four-star running back on the 11th in Ashad Clayton out of New Orleans, Louisiana. This is a kid who's 6 feet tall, 190 pounds. He had offers from half SEC, and he's ranked by Rivals as the number 97 recruit in the entire country and number 9 running back. We're looking at his other offers. He commits to Colorado over Alabama, Arkansas, Auburn, Georgia, LSU. Like, what is Colorado got going on? He also had offers from Nebraska and Texas, and he chooses to go play in Boulder. That's a huge pickup.
Same thing with Brendan Rice, the kid who transferred from Alabama. Mel Tucker's pulling in a SMU. They must got some name, image, likeness. They got some money flowing through Boulder, buddy. No, I'm joking. Like, I'm not accusing him of cheating. I'm just saying, you know, he's got the juice. I mean, he's whatever the Colorado coaches are selling, whatever Mel Tucker is selling. I need to talk to one of these recruits. If you have a chance to talk to one of the Colorado commits, figure out what Mel Tucker's selling. Because that's what I want to know, what his recruiting pitch is right now.
Maybe I'll grab Brendan Rice this week. We'll have him on the podcast because I know Brendan pretty well.
Okay, because it's got to be early playing time, you know, like opportunity. That's got to be what he's selling.
But let's talk about UCLA. Yeah. This is wild because we all know about Chip Kelly's recruiting process, right? Like it goes deep. Like they're you know, they're drawing blood and doing the whole 23andMe thing before they'll take your commitment. And just in the last 2 weeks, so since October 30th, they've landed 6 players, and it almost looks like a Stanford class in that you got a player from Lehigh, Utah, in Johalani Ross, defensive end. You've got 2 players out of Bellflower, California, including 4-star wide receiver Logan Loya. And then you've got a Norcross, Georgia linebacker in Cho Bryant Strother, and another Georgia commit in Miles Jackson. And then they got somebody out of Oakdale, Connecticut, Kenny Mestidor, 6'2", 230-pound defensive end. So all of a sudden, they land 3 defensive ends, a linebacker, an athlete, and a wide receiver in the last 2 weeks. And it's all coming on the heels of their success. So you might look at this and say, oh, UCLA is winning, and so the recruits are coming along. But if you know anything about UCLA recruiting, you know that these guys have probably been waiting to commit 3 or 4 weeks. They're just waiting to get that thumbs up from Chip Kelly.
That's crazy because his approach to recruiting is completely different than everybody else's. Everybody wants to be the kid's best friend. They want them to commit. They want them to feel good. Chip is like, he's sitting in the room like the Godfather. Come here. Are you committed?
Are you? And you know what's crazy is so Colorado and UCLA had huge weeks, right? But the biggest commitment belongs to another school that we wouldn't necessarily consider, you know, a top flight Pac-12 football school, Oregon State. Oregon State lands a transfer from the number 6 defensive end in the 2019 class in Charles Moore. Rivals had him as the number 79 player in the country. He didn't sign until late at Auburn, and he only lasted a couple of months on campus, and then all of a sudden he's headed out there to Corvallis. And Corvallis also hosted, Jack Sears and a couple of other players, and they're really trying to corner the market on the whole transfer portal thing. And what is it that Oregon State's got going on that all of these big-time recruits are looking to start fresh out there? You know, I know that Mike Riley played a big factor in some of those, but, I mean, what is it right now?
Yep. And I think that they see early playing time. They see that they're selling, you can compete with the big boys. You can knock them off. We can build something special here. Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. I mean, even like you said, Jack Sears visited there from USC. Charles Moore. This is whatever Jason Smith and Mel Tucker are doing is absolutely working at this point in time. Like, they're not just going after the fringe kids who, you know, would go to the Mountain West school but are happier at a Pac-12 because they got a bigger offer. No, these are kids who have options. Now we can get to the games this week. So only two Pac-12 teams are not in action this week. So we can start with the Washington Cardinal. The Stanford Cardinal go to they go to the Palouse. They're going to go play Washington State. And it's crazy to me that you have Mike Leach. Everybody, including us, I remember that you mentioned it on the last podcast. Everybody keeps mentioning him with all these big time jobs. And they love the quirky stuff that he does at his press conferences. But not that long ago, he called his team fat, dumb, happy, and entitled. And now he's basically saying that his leaders are frauds. And I think I was always taught that teams are a reflection of the head coach. So if his team is all these bad things, what is the head coach?
I don't know. I'm not going to go as far as calling Mike Leach a fraud, because we know what Washington State was before he got there, and we've seen Texas Tech struggle since he left. It's obvious that he knows the secret sauce. And I just don't think that he's not really somebody who is built to handle losing with grace. He's not one of those people that's a trust the process type guy. If you're failing to trust the process, he doesn't really feel like it's his need to convince you. It's just your fault for not doing the right things, because the right things are so obvious. And so does this work as a motivational tactic? We're going to find out. I think it helps that they've got Stanford this week. And again, Stanford's going to win because I'm going to pick against them. Stanford graduates have been making me feel dumb my entire life. Stanford football has been the thing that has made me feel dumb in the year 2019. Because without Stanford football, I feel like every single week I'm rolling in the dough. Like, if I was betting on these games, I'd be getting paid every week if it wasn't for Stanford. There's no way that I've maybe called one of their games correctly twice this year. You never know what you're going to get with them. And I'm sick of even trying to depend on them, and I expect Washington State to absolutely embarrass them.
I totally agree with you. Oh, and corner is out, number 11, for Stanford, the really good one. Why is my name blanking? Oh Lord. So anyways,
The kid that had multiple interceptions against.
Yeah, he's one.
I know who you're talking about. Hold on one second.
That is the worst thing in the whole world when you know somebody's name. Like, you know their name. You've seen it. You've said it 50 times, no less. And then you're like,
yeah.
What the hell's going on?
Paulson Adebo. Paulson Adebo.
Jeez Louise. So, yeah. And when you look at the defense, Stanford's defense is ranked in terms of scoring defense sixth in the conference. They're giving up 26 points a game, and Adebo is one of the best DBs not only in the conference but in the country. And yeah, this is a huge loss for them, especially going against the air raid. And on the last podcast, we talked about how to stop the air raid offense from Pac-12 coaches. How to stop the air raid. How to stop the air raid, and it works. So Stanford is going to be potentially in trouble. But the biggest concern is their offense. They're only scoring 24 points a game. There is a problem when you're scoring 24 points a game and you're giving up 26 points a game. And Stanford's rushing offense is slowly climbing. They're ninth in the conference, 131 yards a game, ninth in the conference, Ralph. And then their passing offense is fifth in the conference at almost 250 yards a game, but it's not turning into points. And intellectual brutality that we used to know, it is broken. I do not believe that Stanford is, you know, a couple healthy bodies away from being a 10-win team. There's nothing about this team that looks like that they are going to threaten for the Pac-12 championship next year at all.
Stanford has to go 2-1 in their next three games to make a bowl, and those opponents include playing at Washington State and then home against Cal and Notre Dame. Will they even get to 5 wins?
Oh, it's so many people that have Stanford in their bowl projections, and I'm like, are you sure about that? Are you sure? But the way the conference has been going, you know that they will win. You know that they will win and get bowl eligible. But then Washington State, they need this win too to get bowl eligible. I am taking the Cougars in this game. I have kind of turned my stance on Mike Leach. I think he's a great football coach, but he seems like kind of a jerk. Like, so
he is really struggling. Losing Mike Leach is a whole different Mike Leach, in that he is exactly the same, only he takes some of his time that he's talking about, like, what the best thing to do on a hayride is, and he dedicates some of that time to making fun of his own players. Other than that, everything's pretty much the same. Like, if Washington State came out next year with this same exact makeup for the most part, you know, just a new quarterback, and they went 10-2, I would not be shocked at all.
I would agree with that. But another note, so all the Pac-12 games, there's a 1:30 start, a 4:30 start, 5 o'clock start, 7:30, and 8 o'clock start. Put some games on during the time people will freaking watch them, dude. At least Utah is getting a nationally televised game for a change. Arizona State traveling to Oregon State. Jaden Daniels is back. And with the results that have been happening, I have no idea how to pick this game. I feel like this is a pick 'em. I like the fact that Jaden Daniels is back for Arizona State, but Arizona State has done nothing to give me, like, hope and confidence, because in the first quarter of the USC game last week, they gave up 28 points. 28 points. And then they battened down the hatches a little bit. And then Oregon State, whose offense had been playing really well against everybody except for Utah, got absolutely blanked against Washington. And Washington has started a bunch of freshmen. People have been able to score on Washington, except Oregon State could barely move the ball. The only reason why they even scored is because off a pick six.
I think this game is first to 35, which is a little bit of a change of tune for me. You know, with all the time that I spend talking about Arizona State's defense.
Right.
When it comes down to it, man, if you can't get a pass rush, none of it matters. None of it. Keaton Slovis could have been back there making Subway sandwiches, changing gloves between each ingredient, and still had time to throw in the first quarter. That was, I mean, yeah, Keaton Slovis threw for 297 yards in one quarter, but he had all of the time in the world to do it. And that's a huge, huge, huge problem. The thing about Oregon State is they have everything. Every single thing that you need to be a thorn in Arizona State's side, they have it. Patience in the running game, multiple effective running backs who can also catch the ball out of the backfield if you need them to, and then a very accurate quarterback. And if the running game's working, then that sets up the pass for them. Now, if Arizona State can load the box the way that Washington did and shut down the running game and then just say like, hey, just for today only, guys, we're going to put you out on an island against Oregon State's wide receivers. And they match up Chase Lucas or a Jack Jones on Isaiah Hodgins and hope and pray for the best, then you might be able to repeat the performance that Washington put out there. You're not going to shut them out, but you might be able to repeat that performance just as far as not allowing them to use the run to set up the pass. That's Arizona State's best hope in this game. Defensively, Oregon State's not good, and they're not going to all of a sudden start being good. But when you have Hamilcar Rashad, who is leading the country in tackles for loss and leading the Pac-12 in sacks, and he's going to get to go up against the 17-year-old of his choice, that's not going to be a whole lot of fun. And then you're going to run into another situation for the second week in a row where you're talking about an Arizona kid that Arizona State didn't offer who is getting off against who's getting off against the Sun Devils. So, you know, that's the last thing in the world they want to see is Hamilcar Rashad get like three sacks and then have the local media be like, why didn't ASU offer him? He went to the same high school as N'Keal Harry. And yeah, so that's the last thing in the world that ASU wants. So hopefully they put a tight end on him to chip him or something like that. This doesn't feel good coming out of my mouth, but I am going to go with Arizona State in this game only because I think Washington laid out the blueprint for how you get this done. And if ASU can't, then it's a skill issue or potentially a coaching issue that they didn't follow suit and just stack the box and make Jake Luton try to beat them. But again, Arizona State doesn't like to play in Corvallis because they were on the path to the college football playoff in 2014, and they went up there and just got thumped in 20-degree weather. So that's not something that ASU is really looking forward to, is playing up there. So I think it'll be a close game, and I think that Arizona State squeaks it out, and I think having Jaden Daniels back will be a big part of that.
I totally agree. I'm picking Arizona State in this game as well. They are toward the bottom of the rankings in total offense. They're 11th in the conference in total offense, but I don't think that this is necessarily a bad team, because when you look at their opponent first downs allowed, they're fourth in the conference. Like, they're doing a good job of getting people off the field. And the thing that Arizona State's not doing well is third down conversions. They are only getting first downs 41% of the time, which puts them kind of, I guess, that puts you middle of the road in the conference. That puts them eighth, and they're allowing a ton of sacks, like 2.5 a game. So, like, when you have a young quarterback, the whole goal is to keep them clean. And you just mentioned Hamilcar Rashid. If you're going against the third worst team in the conference in sacks, only Arizona and Cal are worse. How does Arizona get sacked so much, FYI, with an athletic quarterback? But whatever.
I don't want to talk about
it. Yeah, exactly. So this is a team that, and Arizona State, though, while they don't give up a ton of first downs, they are 11th in the conference in getting first downs. So they have to do a better job of not having three and outs, continuing to move the football. If they can do that, they can beat. I'm going to go with you and pick them to beat Oregon State. UCLA Bruins, who are officially my team, but I may gift them to Ralph if he keeps being nice, is playing at Utah. Because I will mention again, Ralph said they were only going to win one game. Now he's got to put them in his top five in the Pac-12 power rankings.
Did I say one game or did I say one game per week? I don't remember.
Yeah, so
love the Bruins. Love my Bruins.
You see, Utah's favorite in this game by 21 points, Ralph. 21 points.
Okay. Can I just say there's no way in hell that Utah is winning by 3 touchdowns? Are you kidding me? There's no way.
They are looking at this. They are looking at this like the Utah, like that, the Oregon State game, apparently. Or the Arizona State game.
Is the over under? Is it Utah is favored by 21 points with an over under of 24? Because
no, the over under is 52.
Oh my god, that's easy so that money. You got to be kidding me.
So that's 31 points for them to be. Yeah, so they're saying that UCLA is going to score like 16 points, 15 or 16 points.
George, there's no way there's 52 combined points in this game, right? I mean, UCLA's been playing better defense. UCLA's defense has stepped up.
Yeah, but
this feels like a trap.
I would definitely. which part of it?
It just feels like guaranteed money. It feels like free candy, like a stranger handing you free candy from a windowless van. Like, of course I'm going to take this free candy, stranger. 52? There's no way 52 total points are scored in this game. There's no way. If they're both just hammering the ball with Joshua Kelly and Zach Moss respectively, I don't see 52 point. That would be high for a lot of NFL games, right? I mean, just because this is Pac-12 football doesn't mean that either one of these teams knows how to score touchdowns against each other. I don't, and it's in Salt Lake. Am I wrong about that? So it's not like going to be a great weather game.
Yes, the game is in Salt Lake.
Oh yeah. Man,
yes, it is going to be in Salt Lake. It's supposed to be 55 degrees and clear, I believe.
So, yeah, I don't think they're going to score as many points as the temperature. I'm just going to go ahead and throw that out there. I hate telling people what to do with their money, but, I mean, empty the kids' college fund and throw it on this under and then sweat it out for a couple hours and then profit.
Dude, I am so scared of unders. I've if you look at the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life was there was this last week TCU was playing Baylor. The under was 48. At the end of regulation, there were 17 points. Oh, I'm sorry, 18 points scored because. It was 9-6, and then Baylor kicked a 51-yard field goal to send it into overtime, and then they ended up crushing that 48, and it was only 17 points scored in regulation. That's probably one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life.
That is, there's just like a special stomach ache that's designated for betting unders. Like it's just, it's a feeling that can only be called upon if you bet the under in a basketball game that ends up a free throw mess toward the end. Like, it's definitely the least fun that you can do in gambling is bet an under. But when you hit it, you feel like an absolute genius, and I know that people. What's that whole saying? Life's too short to bet the under, because you know you actually make your life shorter by betting unders and by giving yourself ulcers. But I don't think there's any way that these two teams get together and score 52 points in a game. You watched ASU Utah. You watched that game, right? Like there's I don't know. Ralph, I don't know. I feel better about UCLA's defense in recent weeks, and I just don't think that a banged up Tyler Huntley is gonna. I don't think it's gonna happen. I might put my money where my mouth is.
All right. So, and how are you feeling about those 21 points?
It seems ridiculous. I mean, why can't we all just agree this is going to be a 7-3 Utah win?
Ralph, I am vehemently against you in this one. I'm taking the over in the game. I think that this ends up a high scoring affair, probably 35-27.
Okay.
But there is the caveat that Utah knows that they have to put up a good performance because the committee is watching. The committee is watching Utah. They are watching Oregon. But they need to dominate UCLA. They must dominate UCLA. So I am going to take Utah. And for even though I know the game's going to end up 27-35, I'm going to take UCLA. I'm going to take Utah on the 21 points. I'm going to lay the 21 points with Utah because I saw what they did to Arizona State and I saw what they did to Oregon State. I'm going to take it knowing that I'm an idiot. I am going to take it knowing that Tyler Huntley is probably going to have his best game. Zach Moss is going to go off and their defense is going to like eat Dorian Thompson-Robinson alive. So there's that.
I did see somebody, and it's always leave it to Utah fans to make things weirdly racial. But like someone said that we're going to destroy UCLA because Dorian Thompson Robinson is just a thicker Jaden Daniels. And I'm like, well, like, let's just back off of those comparisons for a moment. I think they're different enough. Dorian Thompson Robinson is much more of like a creator from behind the line of scrimmage. And Jaden Daniels is actually a pocket passer who just is forced to use his athleticism because the offensive line is bad. So I think that Dorian Thompson Robinson will maybe have a little bit of success in just how well he is able to move around, but I still don't think that means his receivers are going to get open.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And Jalen Johnson, all the guys, they are going to be Lecky Fotu. These guys are going to be living in the backfield. Next game up, the Arizona Wildcats travel to Eugene, a game I will be at. Oregon's favored by 27.5 points. The over is 65.5, Ralph. Oregon's, like, when you look at Oregon's stats, it's very, very interesting. Because when you look at their team stats, they do not have a 1,000-yard rusher. They, Justin Herbert has been kind of tame in the fact that even though he's having a really good season, 2,300 yards, 24 touchdowns, 2 picks. Their leading receiver hasn't played in 2 games. The leading receiver on Oregon's team, except for in touchdowns, has not played. No, actually, it might be three games in terms of yards. That's Jacob Breland, the tight end. Here's how Oregon's receptions go. 26, 31, 39, 13, 13, 14, 12, 13, 8, 11, 9. I mean, they have so many dudes with receptions and touchdowns. That is crazy. They have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 different people have caught touchdown passes, let alone rushing. 11 different people have caught touchdown passes. This is a team that is evenly distributed, and it feels more like an LSU, old LSU football team, where they where you would have star wide receivers like Odell Beckham Jr., Jarvis Landry, who can't catch for 1,000 yards, except for the receivers aren't that good.
Yeah, first of all, if I was an NFL scout and I saw the way that Justin Herbert was spreading the ball around, I would put that as a tick in the win column for him. I'm trying very, very, very hard to ignore, because we've sort of entered, we're halfway through the NFL season, right? So we know which teams are going to be picking in the top 10. We know which teams are probably going to need a quarterback. And so draft Twitter is getting louder and louder. And I like draft Twitter, and there's a time and a place for it. In the middle of the college football season, it's very distracting. And ever since they kept me from enjoying Josh Allen's redshirt junior season at Wyoming, I've done my best to ignore, you know, what all of these prognosticators say. Because if you're just trying to enjoy some Oregon football and you're reading all of the content that's relevant to your team, and you're listening to all the content that's relevant to your team, and anytime somebody mentions Justin Herbert is to talk about, you know, how he's going to fail 5 years from now in the NFL, that is extremely distracting. It takes away from the fun of being a college football fan. You're not just sort of allowed to enjoy it in the moment. And this week, it just got ratcheted up to 11. With people starting to talk about Joe Burrow and Tua versus Justin Herbert. And I mean, someone out there had just the absolute dumbest take in the entire world that you have to go with Herbert because he's the actual, like, only NFL prototypical size guy. So now we're talking about size again when, you know, Joe Burrow is 6'4", 215 pounds. And then you had Desmond Howard say that Justin Herbert's not capable of winning a locker room. And it's just like, man, I just want to enjoy college football through the end of the season. And then we can beat this to death and we can start to hate the people that we used to love. Just give us this moment to enjoy college football. And I'm loving what Justin Herbert's doing this year. My favorite thing about Justin Herbert is that you can name his interceptions because there's so few of them. I have more children than he has interceptions. It's easier for me to remember which interceptions he threw than it is for me to not mix up my kids and my dog's names. So, you know, I love what Herbert's doing this year, and I think the NFL scouts probably should too. But all I see every time I go to read anything about Oregon football, anytime I pull up like the recent news, is people wanting to rip Justin Herbert for something he hasn't even done wrong yet for the Cincinnati Bengals in the year 2021.
Well, this is kind of what happens with senior quarterbacks, though. I mean, how many times have we seen senior quarterbacks come back, even ones that end up very successful in the NFL, when they're juniors? Oh, they're hot. Everybody loves them. And then when they come back their senior year, everybody knows they're really good and everybody's saying, oh, wait, hold up. Let's figure out what's wrong with him. There has to be something wrong with him that we're missing. I mean, same thing's happening to Trevor Lawrence right now. Same thing's going to happen to Trevor Lawrence next year when he's draft eligible. They're going to be trying to figure out what's wrong with him instead of what's right with him. Like if Joe Burrow were to have another year at LSU, guess what? People would be picking him apart. But he's a new pretty girl running around. The pretty, you know, he is the new hot girl on campus. I remember when I was at Oregon, there was a young lady that I ended up dating. And when she first showed up on campus, every single player on the football team was like, yo, there's this new girl on campus. Have you seen her? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, nah, because I didn't have any classes with any of the other football players. And boy, I must have saw her. I waited outside of her class where I knew her class got out for 2 days because I didn't know which day she had it, whether it was a Monday, Wednesday class or a Tuesday, Thursday class. Waited, saw her, and the rest was history. So that's kind of what's going on with Joe Burrow. Whole side note, I digress. So who do you have in this game, Ralph? Arizona, Oregon?
So, I mean, the choice is obvious, right? But as long as you have the memory of a goldfish, the choice is obvious. What happened last year? What was it? What was it that happened last year that caused Oregon to get blown out by Arizona?
Coaching. Marcus Arroyo was horrendous calling plays in that game. He was. And the Oregon defense didn't do him any favors either. It was a disaster on both sides of the ball. They made Colin Schooler look like he was Ray Lewis. They made Khalil Tate look like he was Michael Vick. J.J. Taylor looked like he was the Michael James. It was a train wreck. And then the wide receivers, I mean, you thought it was, J.J. Stokes and Freddie Mitchell or Farmer on the side. It was terrible, dude.
All right, so how do I chalk up that result? Do I treat it like an NBA playoff game where, like, one team wins by 30 because the other team knows that it's a long series, and in the second quarter when it looked like the tide was turning, they sort of shut it down so they could focus on tomorrow? Or do I treat it like last year's results, last year's roster, this year's roster, pretty much the same?
I think you have to treat it like that because Oregon got absolutely housed by Washington State last year too. Absolutely demolished.
Yeah.
I know that Braxton Burmeister was quarterbacking at the time, but still. That should never happen. I mean, they got he was not. It was Herbert in that game.
Yeah.
Yeah, not I think it was, no, it was Herbert That was his what the fuck game where he was.
So here's what confused me, and what continues to confuse me is Kevin Sumlin came out this week and he said whoever has the best week of practice gets to start at quarterback, and I just like I felt like I was gonna have a stroke.
Dude, he's
George. This quarterback situation is maddening. It's like he hates them both.
Dude, are you gonna play? I mean, he needs to choose between Grant Gunnell and Khalil Tate. You can't have both because if you play both, he is angling to get himself fired with this. If he were trying to get himself fired, this is exactly what he would do.
Keep what's switching. He do? Is he sees Chad Morris and Willie Taggart get paid off to not work? And he's like, hey, whoever has the best week of practice, like let's forget the fact that Khalil Tate had success against Oregon last year. Oregon's actually the team that figured Khalil Tate out, by the way. When he was in the middle of his sophomore year and he was tearing it up against everybody, it was Oregon that was able to figure out the defensive scheme to limit his ability to do both. That set the blueprint for everybody else. And then so Arizona went back last year and they're like, oh, you're going to worry about Khalil Tate? Well, we're just going to run the ball down your throat all game long. And Oregon was so worried about Khalil Tate that all the running backs got off. This year, it's a little bit different because Oregon has no idea what they're going to see at quarterback. Like, are they going to basically face Noel Mazzoni's version of the air raid? Or are we going to be back with with Khalil Tate again, where it's sort of just a guessing game and a chess match. So maybe ultimately it's the smart thing to do, and it's the thing that gives Arizona the best chance to win is by keeping Oregon on their toes. Or maybe you end up, and God forbid this happens, maybe you end up with a situation where at the end of the year, both quarterbacks are like, yeah, bye. And you have Khalil Tate never rep University of Arizona ever again in anything he ever does, and Grant Gunnell move on to some other school where he's going to be able to know what to expect. And while that might sound ridiculous, let's remember that Kyle Allen, the starting quarterback for the Carolina Panthers, and Kyler Murray, the starting quarterback for the Arizona Cardinals, both simultaneously walked away from Kevin Sumlin instead of either one seizing the starting job at Texas A&M, knowing the other one was leaving. That's how bad that situation ended up being. And I'm just afraid that we're moving toward maybe that same thing happening. Grant Gunnell knows that he's the future, but this coaching staff doesn't seem to know that he's the future. They should just play him. They should just play him. I don't understand why they won't just put him in the game. He is their future. They don't know how to use Khalil Tate. They don't even like Khalil Tate. Why are we still having this is like, I've never watched it, but I see every week on Twitter, like when people are watching The Bachelorette, the producers keep that one character that everybody hates around just to keep people engaged in the show. And all of the normal people watching The Bachelorette are like, why don't they get rid of this dude? He's a psycho. Like, why don't they get rid of him? It's obvious he's not going to win. And it goes week after week after week until he's in the final three, and then finally it happens. Like, that's how I feel about Arizona's treatment of Khalil Tate. Like, you don't like him. You don't know how to use him. It's just causing problems. Why are you flirting with starting him? I don't know. Start Grant Gunnell, lose the game, come back next year, try to win.
Bro, Kevin Sumlin is trying to get himself fired. I mean, there's no other way. But I like Oregon, obviously, in this game. Oregon's playing at home, too. It's not like they're playing in Arizona where the Arizona crowd is going to get into it. There is no chance that there's a shocker on the road. Oregon's favored by 27.5 points. They're probably going to win by 27.5. They're probably going to cover this, too, because Arizona's defense, just in case you were wondering how this shakes out, Arizona's defense gives up 40 40 points a game, 38 points a game they give up, 38, and they give up the most yards out of any defense. Their pass defense is the worst in the Pac-12, the worst. Their rushing defense is ninth in the Pac-12. There is no chance that they don't give up 50 points in this game. That is going to happen. If they, even though that they're coming off a bye, if Oregon doesn't score 50 points, Marcus Arroyo, he would need to go because this team is prime and poised. Yeah, they fired their Marcel Yates. They were worse. Yeah, this is going to be a disaster. The last game of the week, though, USC at Cal. USC is favored by 6.5 points. And to me, they have Chase Garbers back. This is a sucker bet to me, buddy. This is 100% sucker bet to me. I in terms of USC being favored, Cal is going to win this game. They proved last week against Washington State that they still had fight in them. They still want to go to a bowl game. They're going to win this game. And this is the one that's going to make them bowl eligible. And then they're going to, I think they're going to lose to UCLA their last game of the season, but they're going to end up with probably, and then they're going to beat Stanford next week. They're going to end up 7-5, and including this game with USC coming to town, Ralph.
I'm with you. I just watched USC up close. After watching them up close, I like Keaton Slovis. I always have. I look at that offensive line, and I look at their receivers, and this should be – I don't know if this team is built for the air raid. I think that this should be a essentially like a pro-style power running team that that uses Keaton Slovis's accuracy and the talent at receiver to their advantage after establishing the run. I think that's what would give them the most success. But I don't think that they fully understand what it is they are. And if they go there out there and try to do the hybrid air raid stuff against Cal, they're going to get embarrassed. I mean, Arizona State shut them down for 3+ quarters after they had their trouble. So I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. I don't even have much to say about this game. I just think that with Chase Garber's back, I think that that's going to give a huge infusion of confidence to a Cal team that was already playing well enough without him. And as long as Cal can establish the run, I think that they're going to probably control this game. This is a really, really good defense that doesn't have the same amount of trouble getting to the quarterback that an Arizona State does. And so I don't think you're going to see Keaton Slovis go crazy early on in this game. And he's a little bit banged up, too. It's a long season for a true freshman to have to go through like this. He missed some time against Arizona State. He got knocked out for a series. So I do like Cal in this game. I would not be surprised if USC wins because, again, talent lined up against talent. If the coaching staffs don't get in the way, then USC should be winning all of these games. But it's not talent versus talent. It really does come down to coaching, and I trust Justin Wilcox and that entire Cal staff a little bit more than what they have going on in USC.
Okay, so my other question to you is this, is how about the fact that USC runs the air raid now? They run the air raid. And we saw what they did to an air raid team last week in Washington State. They completely strangled them. I mean, they just put a...
Yeah.
Yeah, they just put them in a serious headlock. And I think even though USC's receivers are way, way, way better, and their quarterback's better too, yeah, this is going to be a low-scoring affair. The under is 48.5 points. Which is 20 points.
So it's less than UCLA, Utah. What the hell?
Yep. I'm telling you, because Cal is not going to allow a bunch of points. They don't get hit over the head with 95-yard touchdowns like Arizona State did with who was that? Saint Brown that went 95 DBs bumped into each other like
Mike into triple over the top into triple coverage 95-yard touchdown. It was a thing of beauty.
Yeah, he looked like Michael Vick splitting the Vikings defenders, and they just ran into each other like the Bad News Bears or the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Yep.
So is the question that you're asking me, would they drop the hammer on Clay Helton if they got handled the way that Washington State got handled? Is that what you're getting at?
Dude, look, if USC loses this game, he's getting fired after the game. I think that
they should let him finish, because as you pointed out when we started this podcast, they've got an irregular schedule that has them getting a week off at the end of the season. That would be the right time to do it. Let this staff finish.
Because they have UCLA next week.
Exactly. So let him finish. Like,
yeah, but if you lose
or lame duck him, because didn't Todd Graham coach the game after he was already fired? You've had other coaches coach games after they get fired. So you could break the news that you're getting rid of Clay Helton and the whole staff on the condition that they get to stay for the UCLA.
Dude, they can't lose to UCLA. They cannot. Dude, if they lose to Cal, you have to cut it off, because they can't lose to UCLA with their head coach. They cannot. They can always have that caveat. Oh, we have fired Clay Helton. That's why we lost. Yeah, you can't lose to UCLA next week.
I don't know. Like, Clay Helton's a good dude, and I think that he would do what Todd Graham did, which is know that he's going to get fired, go out there, coach against University of Arizona, win the game, get fired immediately after the game, and then even agree to stay on through the bowl so that they could transition into the Herm Edwards era. I think that you could probably get Clay Helton to agree to something like that. And I think that maybe it, for college kids, it would be the best thing. If you could say like, hey, Clay, look, we're moving in another direction. It didn't work out, but we want to give you the opportunity to stick around, not only to coach against UCLA, you know, let him know now. If they lose to Cal, let him know and say like, and you know, depending on the bowl, if we end up in Las Vegas and it's a pre-Christmas bowl, would you stay on, stay with the team and possibly end on a positive note? Which can go a long way to sort of rehabilitating a coach's image within that alumni base, as well as, you know, prospects for a potential future gig. Of course, that's not how it worked for Todd Graham. They got wrecked by North Carolina State, and he hasn't worked since. but I think that it's better to maybe keep everybody together, or maybe there's somebody on the staff that you do want to give a shot to say like, oh, how would you, if you are looking at an internal hire, which I don't think they should, you know, giving somebody the reins for just a week to see how that might look. But I don't think there's anybody on this USC staff that would even come within 10 miles of being a candidate.
Oh yeah, no, I 100% agree, dude. That USC's coaching search is going to be much harder than people believe. That I mean, I know that James Franklin may want to come out here, that there are some other big name guys, but I don't think it's going to be as smooth as people think it's going to be, especially if they don't hire Urban Meyer. You guys, thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles podcast. You know, we come out every Monday and Thursday. We appreciate your time. Appreciate your energy. Peace out. Have great games this weekend. Enjoy them. And don't forget to send us an email. I'm mad at unforhshow.com.